Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland, made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Master Sommelier Joshua Nadel. We'll talk to Josh about wine, hospitality, becoming a Master Somm, and a lot more. We'll taste of Verdicchio that Josh brought in from the Limarque region of Italy. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us on the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. All right. Josh Nadel is a master sommelier and the beverage director for Andrew Carmelini's NoHo Hospitality Group. He spent nearly a decade as head sommelier at revered and award-winning restaurants Veritas and Crew in New York City before joining Carmelini in 2009. Josh oversees the beverage and wine programs at restaurants like Locanda Verde, The Dutch, Lafayette, Bar Premi, Luca, Rye Street Tavern in Baltimore, and a bunch more. Josh launched Gothic Wine, his wine company, in 2009, producing Cool Climate Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Rosé from the Willamette Valley in Oregon. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Glad to be here.
All right, so let's give people an idea. I gave a little tip-off in the intro, but give us a quick background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are current, which is the beverage director for pretty much a restaurant empire.
Sure. I'll fast forward to maybe high school or college.
But, okay.
Hopefully that's where it started. My father was a bartender, dining room cater waiter guy in the Borscht Belt in the Catskills.
Really?
Yeah, you got kind of Dirty Dancing style.
What? And, do you remember hotels?
May have been the Raleigh, of that ilk.
Classic.
Right? And so there was always kind of a undercurrent of that being around and okay. All of my family are educators, actually, whether it be principals, administrators in education, teachers, English, Spanish, math, literally, it's uncanny. Even my sister is a speech pathologist. Wow. There's something in the DNA. And my first job as a, you know, past like babysitting and washing cars was at a bagel shop.
Okay.
And then as a cater waiter, senior year, my dad said, I'm going to teach you how to carry a tray because you might come in handy one day. So we put on tuxedos and, you know, went up to the catering halls of Westchester, New Jersey, and that kind of stuff. So I went to art school. I have a degree in fine arts and drawing and printmaking from SUNY Purchase in Westchester.
Drawing and
printmaking, lithography, and so it's
Jesus,
it came
so
in,
far nothing points to anything.
But
you're
no,
doing.
But it came in the tray carrying came in real handy. Okay. After that. So it was kind of, let's try to maybe be, you know, eat some Campbell soup and rice and be an artist, maybe be a teacher. And in order to do that, and go back to grad school, I actually was going to go to the University of Glasgow. They have a great printmaking school. And I was working in restaurants to save money for tuition. And after about a year, I worked at a restaurant called Ruby Foo's on 77th and Broadway.
Steve Hansen's.
There was a time not so long ago where those were hits, you know, Blue Water Grill.
Broadway, Ruby Upper Foo, West. 77th and Broadway. Because he opened close to Broadway, Midtown.
Yeah, Midtown. The first one. Not a place I go that much. So,
no.
I had a girlfriend at Barnard at the time. It was perfect. So they had actually a really great culture of education there. And an unusual wine list. It was kind of when the term Pan-Asian was a buzzword in cuisine. So we had all Burgundy and German wine and this kind of weird stuff. And I got really interested. And my friends there, who were kind of my mentors as servers, were also very into it.
Was Laura Maniac there came after?
Laura Maniac, I was a server trainer, and she trailed me as a prospective employee.
Ah,
so I'm dating myself.
It's a good timeline.
And now we're brother and sister. We're best of friends. She really is one of my closest friends. And then, you know, through my journey as trying to go for the MS, she was very helpful and her mentor to me. So, that kind of one thing led to another. And as I had enough year for, I had enough money for 1 year of tuition. I did a little work as a harvest assistant when I got into wine out in Napa Valley. I worked a few weeks of a crush, came back to New York to save money. And just as I was going to get ready to take the dive to the University of Glasgow, I was working as kind of like a sommelier wine person, at a Midtown steakhouse restaurant.
Tuscan Steak.
Yeah. For China Grill Management. That's right.
On the east side. 40th in the 40s.
And 3rd. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Big place.
Huge. Yeah. Huge place. Three ring circus, the whole thing. I cold faxed my resume to Veritas Restaurant as a 23 or 24 year old, eager, you know, ambitious kid. And the wine director there took a huge chance on me.
But stop for a second.
Yeah.
You realized and recognized Veritas was like the happening.
It was the greatest wine program.
And you just aspired, you know, let me fax this guy something, see if I get.
I had gone in and applied as a waiter.
That's kind of ballsy, right?
Well, I had gone in and applied as a waiter as about 6 months prior.
Okay.
And got no callback, no nothing, just dropped off a resume, and they probably circle filed it immediately. And there it was a friend of mine who was working at Mesa Grill. Her name was Dominique Bell. Her name is Dominique Bell, one of those mentors to me. Worked at Mesa Grill and said, hey, there's this restaurant Veritas that's looking for an assistant sommelier. My sales rep from such and such company just told me you should fax your resume. And it had on it, you know, server trainer Ruby Foo's, assistant teacher at the Dalton School, and like who knows what, and my current wine director job at the time, head sommelier job at the time. One page, 8.5 by 11, Times New Roman font.
You said they took a chance.
This guy Tim Kopeck, who is
Tim is
he's
big blonde mane of hair.
Yeah,
big
he's one of
guy.
The most charismatic people I've ever met in service, and capable, and just I still repeat some things that he said. He hired me, and it was a very long interview, and he took a chance on me, and I owe him a tremendous amount for where
what
I am
do
today.
You think? You said it was a long interview.
Yep.
What do you think the connection was? Was it your passion? You had a decent amount of knowledge up until that time. You were a good guy. I mean, what do you think swung
it
to him?
I think he saw in me somebody willing to work very hard, not looking to do things my way, because I had no idea what that was, really interested in learning. And I think he was going away on a vacation in about 2.5 weeks.
Good timing, right?
And so he needed someone really badly. And the other sommelier at the time was very strong, Eric Zillier. So they could take a chance on somebody who was a little more intro.
So you do that for
4 years.
And then you move to...
Then I took a little bit of time off. Actually spent a few months for a startup kind of techie distributor, kind of like just trying to disrupt the model a little bit. That blew up spectacularly. And then I found my way to Crew, who really at the time was really hitting its stride as the other great wine destination in the United States. And I spent, 3 or 4 years there.
Incredible.
It was
the two places
combined
had the greatest Burgundy and Bordeaux and everything in between.
Yeah. I am.
Who was
not a day goes by that I'm not appreciative and that I don't I never take it for granted that I was very fortunate to be in those two places at the specific times when I was there. It was the
Veritas's
list was the best, I was there. When Crew's list, I was there.
Who was the crew when you were there? Was Robert Bohr there?
Bohr was there. You know, he was a little more of a managing partner by the time I got there. Right. The restaurant had been fully baked.
Not a floor guy.
Yeah, he's definitely there and worked the floor a lot. But, you know, he had sommeliers myself, Michelle Couvreau, Alex Miranda. Were there. John Slover was doing a lot of the administration and nuts and bolts of running the cellar.
So you do that for 3 years, and what happens? This leads to really what you're doing now?
Well, there was a little blip in there, and after that period of time, there was always someone above me on the food chain, Tim Kopeck, Robert Bohr, and whoever it was, and I said it's time to kind of make my own reign a little bit. So when the Plaza Hotel reopened, when they opened the Oak Room and the Oak Bar, they had a huge wine budget, and it was actually Robert who hooked me up with the people there. He said, maybe this is an opportunity for you. And I mean, it was an epic disaster. The people were unethical, bad operators, the people operating the Oak Room.
Did you walk away from it?
It was a kind of like a, there was a lot of F-bombs dropped at the final conversation. I don't remember who said what to who first, but it was horrifying.
That
but
doesn't sound good.
It was a very stressful time for everybody. We opened 2 weeks before the market crashed in 2008. I mean, we literally opened like October 1st or the last week of September. So 10 days in, it was 800 points. So it was hard. And I remember actually you mentioned Laura Manick. I called her one day in March. And I said, listen, this job sucks. I would rather be taking the garbage out of the bagel shop when I was 16.
Just to be happy.
I'm just going to move to California. I'm going to work a couple of harvests and just kind of see what happens. And she said, listen, I just closed 3 restaurants. I just laid off 400 people. So shut up. You know, be...
This is when she was with Hanson, right?
Yeah. You know, understand how fortunate you are to have a job. Deal with it in whatever way you know how to deal with. And it was an interesting conversation. But eventually, you know, later on that spring, it was just like kind of like, F you, you know, here are the keys. And
so how does the NoHo Carmelini...
Oh, right. So Josh Picard, who I've heard was the senior partner there, calls me. And we knew each other from the biz. And he softballed, soft-souled, this kind of thing I'm doing with this guy. Do you ever heard of this guy, Andrew Carmelini? The program's a little small. Maybe we can do like AGM/beverage director, of course, the slash. It worked out. It worked out real well. And I said, I'm going to give this one. I'm going to give New York one. I'm born and raised here. Proud as all hell to be a New Yorker. But at the time, the world was ending. Sky was falling. Right. So I said, I'll give New York one more try. You know, line up with Carmelini. If it's not going to work with Carmelini and Picard and these guys, then I got to do something else.
And you have a good reason to leave town.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was Locanda Verde.
Yep.
All right. So we'll come back to
April.
That. Yeah. So 2009, yep. And from 2009 till now. In a few minutes, we'll talk about how things progressed and all that. But like I said, I want to come back to that. I want to talk to you about being a master sommelier. I know they just announced the new batch.
Yep.
But you were recently minted Master Somm late last year, so it should still be pretty fresh in our mind.
It
and
is.
I think you're the fifth Master Somm. I think we've had 4 Master Somms on and 1 Master of Wine.
Oh, cool. Yeah, Pascaline, I saw, yeah.
No, yeah, Pascaline. But Isabel Legeron, I think, is a master of wine,
okay,
who runs that whole raw wine movement and all that. But I don't get into it that heavily, but I think it would be interesting to talk with you because, you know, it was that big climb. It just happened. You achieved it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it should be somewhat fresh in your mind. Give people an idea. The type of time and commitment you put in to achieve this certification.
Sure. The first couple, there are 4 levels of the exam, and when I was taking it, there were actually only 3. If you're working in service, the first 2 are...
Should be at least that.
Yeah, the first two are relatively, not easy, but attainable. If you were working with wine on the floor of a restaurant,
If you give a crap, you'll get
it. Yeah. I think the first 2 are, the first one is actually an introductory course. It's not even called sommelier because it's just a multiple choice exam. But, in the beginning, I wasn't really working in an environment that really not necessarily wasn't supportive of, but they did, there was no reason at Crew and Veritas to be doing this because you had the greatest wines of the world. You either knew them or you didn't, and you could serve them or you couldn't. But then when I started into it, I took the advanced level 3 times and then the master exam 6 times. And that had a lot to do, again, with my background, which was the first 10 years of being a sommelier, I tasted Pinot Grigio and Malbec 5 times, right? I was drinking Latoche and Grand Cru this and Great Barolo. And it sounds really shitty and bratty, but it's just what it was. And I was okay with that. So it took me a while. And there are 3 portions of the exam. There's a practical service examination, a theory examination, and tasting.
Break, just before you go forward, break quickly what each...
Sure. So the tasting exam is a 6 wines, 3 whites and 3 reds. And you have 25 minutes to identify about 30 points of analysis in each wine, which is sight, nose, palate, and then conclusions. And palate, for example, is flavors, structure, tannin, acid, alcohol, intensity of certain things, and to the point where it's a deductive tasting process, and you kind of put all your clues in a box.
So you're just shooting out black currant, cloudy, you know.
Well, there's kind of a little bit of a mantra there, and it's not a subjective thing. It's a grid with points, and an Albarino is this. And if you say it, an Albarino has medium acid, and it's gridded by the master sommeliers as medium plus, you don't get the point.
Really?
Yeah, and a classic Albarino has this, this, and this. Right. It looks like this on the grid. So you have 6 of those. You have 25.
So you're sitting across with 6 glasses with another master
somm. 3 usually scoring, so they don't miss anything.
Okay.
Sometimes there's even a 4th auditing or something like that. And you have 25 minutes, and it's just, you know, Mr. Nadel, welcome again. Good to see you. You've got a bottle of water in front of you, and this is your time. The clock starts when the...
So that's the tasting. Yeah, that's tasting. 1 of the 3. Yeah. Next.
Then you have the theory, which is 150 or so. I think it might be a little more, a little less. 150 and that questions, oral exam.
It's a test.
That it could be... It's 2 master sommeliers sitting across from you, and it's just... You know, what is the this? Or please do
is
this.
Is it oral back and forth? It's oral, not a written.
Yeah, it's oral back and forth. It makes it quite a bit more difficult.
So
and it's anything about wine, spirits, beverage, any kind of alcohol. There aren't any questions about cigars or anything like that anymore, or really any, let's say, coffee or tea or anything like that. But spirits, wine, beer, anything.
Being a master sommelier, you have to be prolific in beverage, spirits, all of that
stuff. If it's just wine, you won't get through.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it could be absolutely anything. Mezcal, bourbon, sour beer, and every wine law, anything that could possibly appear on a label, elevations. You know, do you have mastery of that subject? If you're talking about Fiano Diavolino, which is a fantastic wine from southern Italy and Campania, do you know the soil? Do you know what elevations? Do you know the things that impact the terroir, the intrinsic kind of characters of that grape and what makes it what it is, right? Of any subject in the world of beverage. And then you have the practical or the service exam. And that's split into 2 pieces. There's the business of a sommelier, which is inventory, pricing, costing, how to financially run a program successfully. That's a written exam. There's some tastings in there and things like that. That's a timed exercise. And then you go into the room and you perform service, which is about another 45 minutes, which simulates a restaurant environment.
Right.
That's hopefully a lot of fun. It's very nerve-wracking.
Watch very closely.
Yeah.
You know, you got to serve on the right. You can't drop a champagne glass.
It's food and wine pairing, service, and service could be anything. There could be any scenario.
Answering questions?
They'll
ask you, you know, what's...
While you're pouring something, I didn't want that, or actually my friend doesn't want that. Now pour. It's, you know, I'm only allowed to describe the exam to such an acute degree, but it is absolutely anything that could possibly happen in a restaurant at the highest level.
So a good way for people to connect to that... Let's just talk about Uncorked for a minute.
Sure.
There's a 3rd Somm movie coming out.
I think it's out. Yeah.
It's happening now. Yeah. These are movies about the whole Somm, you know, test process and the people. But a few years ago, there was a TV series called Uncorked, of which there were 6 Somms. You were one of the featured. And they show every test.
Yeah, they're not allowed into the exam rooms. But
well, they show the practice.
The preparation and the practices.
Right. But what the service looks like and sitting across for all of...
I felt it did a pretty good job of capturing our personalities. The
Yes.
You know, the preparation, I think it did a decent job capture, you know, when I would study for theory, I would sit there for, you know, 3 or 4 hours before work, a couple hours after work. On my days off, I'd study for 8 to 10 hours a day without getting up from the chair ever. I wish there was like a time lapse thing on it. It was just kind of, I was a little relentless with the theory. That was kind of my thing.
In the end, and looking back, you had to be.
Yeah, the theory is very difficult.
Yeah.
Very difficult. The TV show was fun.
Yeah. So I think, I forgot who, if it's, you know, Netflix or whoever.
I think it's on the Esquire network.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But somebody's carrying it. But it's called Uncorked, and you'll see Josh and five really other wonderful people, the intensity of that test. So all in, it took you what?
About 10 years. I mean, because intro and cert intro happened pretty quickly. Then I took advanced 3 and then master 6. And there was 1 year in between at some point. So you know, 11 years.
I never asked anybody this, and it's sort of none of my business. But
shoot,
the amount of bread you have to put into this money, I mean, you have to it's travel. Serious. I mean, you're not that you,
yeah.
A big part of what you're making is feeding this test. Because if you're called to St. Louis or Maryland, and then
how about Aspen?
Aspen.
Aspen was five master exams in Aspen, and then the sixth that I actually passed was in St. Louis. So it's a week off of work, hotel room, flight, travel.
Crazy.
And then the practice and the wines. Yeah, it's legit.
And you took the MS?
Six.
Right. So six trips.
You reset, and I should say you get three chances to pass all three parts, and if you don't, you reset to zero. It's
right.
Like you don't go to, don't pass go.
Which
go
is an Uncorked too. I mean, if you really want to know the behind the scenes, watch Psalm 1 and watch Uncorked, and you'll see Josh. All right, so that's sort of that process. I mean, really in a nutshell, because it's like 19 years of,
sure.
You know,
yeah, we've only got an hour.
Yeah, so, yeah. But it's one thing to be a Psalm, in your case, at one restaurant, which a lot of people do. It's another thing where you're overseeing a program at a... pretty happening, busy company, NoHo and Andrew Carmelini. Places like I said, like Locanda Verde, Bar Premi, Little Park, Lafayette. Talk to me as best as you can, because I know every day differs.
Yeah.
But what are you doing every day? I mean, you got a crew at every place, inventory. I mean, are you on the floor? Just give me an idea.
It literally depends on the day, and I can tell you that. We are so proud of our programs, and we have such an amazing beverage team at NoHo. It's fantastic. You know, we go out to
dims. But that's a kudo to you. You've assembled a team, right?
I guess, yeah, yeah. I hopefully, yeah. That's very kind of you to say. Yeah.
It's important.
Yeah. But I could be literally doing anything from receiving a delivery and taking
schlepping
bags
the boxes
and
down.
taking 1,000 pounds of ice off the loading dock and filling an ice machine, and I have done that in the past month. That
suit,
and it's not that I, you know, I'm a New Yorker, so I have a little chip on my shoulder about it, but that's not what I want to be doing. Or I could be sitting in an office and building a beverage program for, you know, for example, a property we're opening in Detroit this winter. So right now we're building programs, training materials, and we're getting hot on deliverables for that. Working the floor because it's going to be a busy night and it's going to be fun. And
how
I want
do you
land
determine
some extra support.
Working the floor? Like if you know...
Well, I think first phase is...
Like all these restaurants, why would you be at Locanda versus, Premi?
Right. Well, I think first layer of the onion is, do they need a pinch hitter? Is someone on vacation? Are we short somebody?
So you're always in the bullpen.
I'm always on the bed. Yeah, I'm always in the bullpen and warm. Right. I'm always warm.
Right.
And then it could just be kind of a, Saturday night in September at Lafayette. If it's a nice night, that place is going to be cranking. And they've got, if 90 seats are rolling on the porch, or at Little Park, if they're super busy and what they're doing with their food right now, I think it's going to be a really amazing fall for them. And that could be a situation where maybe they, if the bar is hopping, that they have a cocktail bar called Evening Bar on the other side of the hotel. So the bar is going and the dining room's got two and a half full turns. I want to be there.
Right.
And that's the good stuff.
So even though you're a fancy pants master sommelier, you're still schlepping ice, you're still working the floor, but you get into heady stuff like, planning the opening of
I'm in the last couple of years I've gotten really into working a little more with designers and trades, building everything, building the bars, building the stations, storage, things like that.
So before we move off of that, what's the largest and or the prestige wine program in New York?
For our programs?
You guys, yeah.
I think, well, before we get to that, I wanted to say one other thing that I do that I think is important is that I find myself working directly more with importers now, you know, when I take meetings and stuff like that. And that's been a real helpful thing to managing programs that may be in different states or larger volumes and things like that.
Right.
So I find myself rather than, I taste a lot of wine, but more often than not, I'm tasting wines with importers rather than just the distributors.
Doing that more than you've done in the past.
Yeah, yeah. So our programs are really interesting, and they're very different. One of the things that we're super proud of is the presentation of our programs. If you walk into any of our restaurants and you look at the wine lists, particularly what we've done at the Dutch, Locanda, and Lafayette, they're educational without being boring. We've got incredible, points of geographical references, maps, little tidbits, recommendations, and guests seem to like them very much. We get a lot of great comments on them.
So there's some thought behind the entries and all that.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Fun, educational.
Yeah, they're pretty cool. And I think Locanda has the deepest cellar. In fact, we just invested a little bit of extra coin into that program for that program on the Dutch this year, for some older wines, really with a focus at Locanda in Piedmont.
Yeah, I would think people would want to come in and look for an old Barolo or something. Well, they'd expect you to have something.
You know, it is with all, yeah, it's my favorite wine. So
fun thing to stock up on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
So, you know, we don't have the kind of Maialino Del Posto situation going on there, but we really took a look at the success and the request of our guests, and that's what they want. So we're going to, it's really, really extraordinary. The list is actually going to be live in the next 10 days or so.
Nice.
And the list is looking amazing. And then the Dutch, we did the same thing at the Dutch last year with a little more old American wine, it's an all-American program
made sense
there. Yeah, so we put some library stuff together.
Right. What's the funkiest?
A little park. I'm not...
Because of the food and the type
It's a global wine program, right. And they really... the wine team there, particularly Kristen, who's the wine director and manager, and then Cara, who's the head sommelier there, they love finding unusual stuff from the Canary Islands and Corsica and stuff that's really off the beaten track. And because of the cuisine, you can really run the spectrum there. It's not funky in that the wines are kind of like orange science experiments that are flawed and foisted on the general public by hipsters, but they're just really
wider.
Interesting wine.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, really beautiful stuff.
All right, so we're talking to Josh Nadel. Josh is a master sommelier. He runs the beverage program. Josh, I want you to dig into this a little, and then we're going to take a break, come back, talk about a few more things, and... do the wine list, and we'll taste some wine. But I'm curious, because you're not an old guy by any stretch, but you've been in the market a long time. I'm curious how you see how things have changed since you've been in the business. And I have a list of things. You know, millennials entering the market, baby boomers, you know, aging out. We just addressed it for a second, how the natural wine movement, you know, plays to you, social media. So... has the market changed? I mean, are millennials a big impact on the market yet? Not yet? Not your places?
I mean, I think in New York, this is just paradise for selling wine, because people are pretty Europhilic here and pretty open-minded, and they've traveled a lot. There's incredible information exchange now at a dizzying pace about delicious wines. So in New York, I think there's been an explosion of exploration and discovery into regions.
Does that go under the social media box? Does social media drive that?
A little, but I think you have people like Ian D'Agata and Vinnis, Josh Reynolds, Steven Tanzer that are just doing amazing things, bringing wine to the people. And then you have people... the wine has gotten more expensive, and so people naturally look to what's a little bit more modest. And you have places like the Loire Valley, and it goes down to importers and sommeliers and wine directors and people being open-minded towards all this stuff. And I think social media maybe is kind of like some kind of stamp of validation after the fact.
Maybe.
And maybe it drives a few more people to try things, but I think it happens before that. And
you make a good case that it happens before that. The people you mentioned, the way they do it, the passion that they do.
Frankly, the sommelier or the guest does not take that picture of that wine unless an importer goes and finds it. Unless the person makes the good wine, the importer goes and finds it, brings it to you. The sommelier or a shopkeeper now that has to choose it and vet it and put it on the shelf and be an ambassador for that wine. Social media helps, but it's not the genesis.
Right. Don't you think right now there's more importing and importers, small, medium, and large,
that's awesome,
that have really kind of trucked through every French, Italian, Eastern European countryside and just bringing wine back at like a dizzying pace?
It's amazing.
You love that, right?
All we have to do is sit here and make appointments and meet them for lunch or a coffee and choose wine. It's amazing. I think Italy still has a long way to go and so many stones unturned
as
in
Italy. As far as people needing representation or...
Just so the amount of great wine in Italy or the amount of good wine that's left undiscovered is
really,
it's crazy. Yeah,
I'm amazed when I go to tastings or portfolio tastings that there's unrepresented people.
Yeah,
I guess you could.
Listen, the world only had money to spend on wine 30 years ago, right?
Yeah,
go back to New York was bankrupt.
Yeah,
so
do you feel also there's been a proliferation of restaurants? Doesn't it seem like more places are opening and the diversity of food?
Yeah,
it's always seemed.
I think so. I think it's plateauing a little bit. Labor laws and how expensive it is. I think we'll see a little bit of a slowdown.
Yeah.
We work a lot.
Rents.
It's cyclical like anything else. Yeah. And the natural wine.
We're at the high, pushing the high end.
Yeah.
I guess you would say
it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough right now. I'm really glad that people are making a better living, particularly in the back of the house. It had to happen.
Right.
But it's a curveball for the operators.
Have Somms changed much? I mean, are there any Tim Kopecks left?
There's only one Tim Kopeck.
But I mean, that kind of guy, is that the style still? Or it's evolved into something different?
There is a lot more younger and kind of entry-level sommeliers. There are a lot more sommeliers who think they are qualified to be sommeliers because they have academic knowledge and a little bit less of that kind of apprentice model that I think is the most helpful. When we take in a young sommelier, the first thing they do is they have to be one of the best waiters in the room. Then they get to play in the wine cellar and unpack boxes and do inventory.
Then they
get to train the new staff on wines by the glass and things like that. And then one day when someone's on vacation, they get, or they stub their toe, we say, hey, it's Thursday, we're short a sommelier, we need you to do this. They just kind of say, oh, this is what I normally do. I'm just dressed a little differently.
Right.
So that's a good thing. Yeah. So I don't know if sommeliers have changed. I think there's a real amazing capacity to look for new stuff and be really open-minded.
That's sometimes changed.
To a fault, but yeah. I don't have the kids these days, thing. But there's definitely a few junior burgers out there that don't quite have it that think they do.
There's the old story, you graduate Cornell as a programmer, you're like a internet entrepreneur. You love wine and you work in a restaurant and you take one test, you're a sommelier. It's not that easy.
Yeah, it doesn't work like that.
All right, Josh, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Josh Nadel, beverage director for NoHo Hospitality. When we come back, I have a few more questions for Josh. I want to subject him to our wine list. And Josh brought in a Verdicchio from the La Marche region, which he's going to open up now. You're listening to The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition.
They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of the Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Der Scharfer Max, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Josh Nadel. Master Sommelier Josh Nadel. Josh, you're sort of an ambassador and a lover of wines from the Alsace.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
I actually attended a master seminar that you gave with, who was it, Terry Fritsch?
Yeah, Terry.
And I actually had a chance to sit down and interview you guys about Alsatian wines, but like glasses and tables were flying around, so I'm trying to figure out how to edit that.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this gravitation or love towards Alsatian wines.
Well, for me, I love, for white wine, I love white wine with flavor. I don't love neutral white wine, and I don't love white wine that goes into new oak barrels.
So obviously Alsatian is wine with flavor. Give me a good example of one that's not in your mind.
Oh, you know
the classic opposite.
Chardonnay.
Okay.
Chardonnay goes into oak barrels and is a neutral varietal.
Say no more.
Yeah. Muscadet, Chardonnay, stuff like that. Neutral varietals.
Alsatian's predominantly white, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of Pinot Noir on the ground, but Alsatian wine, you know, because of the rain shadow of the Vosges Mountains, gets a lot of sunshine, and the grapes can hang pretty deep into the summer and fall. You don't really have to worry about it. So you have these aromatic varietals: Riesling, Gewürztraminer, Muscat, Pinot Gris. The Pinot Gris of Alsace is a totally different animal than Pinot Grigio in Italy and Pinot Gris in Oregon, for example. And so I love Austrian wine that has a lot of ripeness to it, Alsatian wine, unadulterated by oak, which I think is better for pairing food. And it also has the most complex geology. So you have half a dozen different varietals. You've got the most complex geology on earth in which to grow
Explain
wine.
Explain geology. I mean, literally soil and the
granite,
stone.
Granite, schist, sandstone, limestone, everything. And it's because of the way that the faults worked out over a million years, millions and millions of years and things like that. But it's just a patchwork quilt of different soils, even with the same
vineyard. And the impact on the wines is crazy.
Yeah, it could be anything.
From one stone, you know, base to another.
Correct. I mean, if you're growing blueberries or roses or grapes, it's you know, wine is very romantic and foreign to some people, but it's gardening, right, at a very high level.
So give our listeners a little intel. Give me one or two recos of producers that are accessible. Give me a variety. Yeah.
Yeah. So some of my favorites, Ostertag, Boxler, Weinbach.
O-S-T-E-R, T-A-G.
T-A-G, yeah, Ostertag. Weinbach with a W, okay. W-E-I-N-B-A-C-H. Boxler, like a boxer with an L. A few that come to mind.
And they're making Riesling.
Yeah, the Riesling Pinot Gris.
Gruner.
No, Gruner is Austrian.
It is all Austrian.
Yeah,
okay.
Pinot Gris, you know, Zinnenbrecht makes great wine. There, I mean, there are so many, and Barmes Boucher, Albert Mann. There are so many fantastic producers. Trimbach, if you want kind of like a more lean taut style, that makes such fantastic wines. Bottgeil, everybody always concentrates, Schofield, Dice. They concentrate on the big four, this Zinnenbrecht, Trimbach, and a few other ones, and Weinbach Plus. But there are so many people making fantastic wine there.
That's where and when you go into a wine store that you like and trust.
And you ask. Yeah.
A little better and say, I want to try this stuff. Yeah. And he'll have stuff beyond the big four and all of that, which we would hope. Tell me about other regions that currently are exciting you or you're tasting, anything new?
I just got back from Le Marque, and then we'll talk about that when we taste this Verdicchio. I think the upper regions of the Lange, so above Barolo and Barbaresco. Barolo, Barbaresco getting expensive, getting tough to find the great wines, and the areas north of that. which focus on the Nebbiolo grape, you know, Gemme, Gattinara, a few places up there. Brahmaterra is a place that I like quite a bit. They're very tasty, and the wines are Valtellina is another place in Lombardy.
You're outside of Barolo.
Yeah.
Would you say you're north?
Yeah, the northern, where the soil's a little less.
Is that Lange?
Yeah, the upper part.
L-A-N-G-H-E, right?
Yeah, the upper part of the Lange.
Lange.
And quite frankly, Barbaresco is very delicious too, and less expensive and easier to get at.
What about like Barbera d'Alba, d'Asti?
Yeah, those are fun everyday wines. I think they're very consistent. They're a little bit less, you know, if you're asking me about what things that are at the top, tip of my tongue for most exciting.
Not that.
Probably not going to be at it, but we serve a lot of those wines, and they're great everyday table wines. I think the wines of Campania are very exciting to me right now. I think they're the...
Talk to me about some of the grapes in Campania.
Well, by far and away, there's a grape called Aglianico, and Aglianico is really the third great red grape of Italy besides Nebbiolo and Sangiovese. It's a thick-skinned...
A-G-L-I-A-N...
A-G-L-I-A-N-I-C-O.
C-O, right.
Yeah, so Aglianico.
Aglianico.
Correct, yeah. Small clusters of thick-skinned grapes, and gives a full-bodied red wine, which usually goes into oak barrels with a dark color, and, you know, moderate plus to high tannin. And these are things that lovers of full-bodied wines around the world can easily identify with. It's the way I feel about Bandol, the oak-aged Morvedre from southern France.
Right.
And it's very difficult not to like these wines. It's a little bit more austere on the palate than a juicy California Cabernet. But we're having it with food. It's fantastic. And I think there's... The wines of Campania and Basilicata that are made from Aglianico are going to be some of the most accessible, full-bodied, age-worthy red wines. You know, Basilicata, there's a producer Grifalco, that I like quite a bit.
Spell for me.
G-R-I-F-A-L-C-O.
Grifalco.
Yep. In Campania, there are various producers of Taurasi, which is T-A-U-R. ASI, that's really the great red wine of southern Italy.
Right.
Many producers, you really can't go wrong with
just
that wine.
A Taurasi from Campania is a great play.
That's, you just start there and go.
And it's a big, bold red wine,
correct.
Right? Just give me a quick food pairing. It'd be great with...
You want the meats, lamb,
barbecue,
steak.
Barbecue, lamb, steak, juicy burgers.
Yeah, and I think you should have, you know, I'm one of those people who thinks you should drink what you want, how you want it, but that's the texture of that wine is tough without food, no question about it.
So Taurasi is a great food wine.
Yeah, great full body.
But goes up
wine.
Against big foods.
Yeah, for sure. Verdicchio, and I just got back from this area on the Adriatic coast, and I think, you know, what I said to the producers that we were hanging out with there, and you know, I have Ian Daggett to thank for setting up this magnificent thing he put together called Collisione. It's a fantastic kind of collision of art and music and food and wine and things like this. Americans love Italian stuff. We know it, but we don't necessarily...
And back at you, why they, you know, France, you get a little attitude.
You know. I mean, I love French. It's really the first 10 years of my life was French, 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 and Italian was like...
But
oh,
you're right about Italy.
It's fantastic. So we know we love Italian food, wine, cars, design, culture, history... everything. I would say that I don't love Italian travel. They still have to, they haven't figured that one out yet. But so you go into a restaurant and you drink red wine. Okay, we had a Chianti, we had a Montepulciano, Brunello, Barolo, kind of have an ideal about that. Italian white wine, and we want to have some white. Or having fish and salads first. What do we have? What is the average consumer or enthusiast consciousness full of when it comes to Italian white wine? Pinot Grigio? What else, right? So Verdicchio to me is one, a whole lot more complex and flavorful and rewarding than Pinot Grigio. And good Pinot Grigio is fine.
Right. Most people don't.
Venica makes a fantastic one. Packerhoff makes a very good one. Alto Adige up north, which is basically, it's only been Italy since 1919. Very, very Germanic in everything it does, Austrian. But this grape gives you so much more flavor, so much more complexity, the opportunity to harvest it early or late. And it has a collection of growers there that are a cohesive unit who want to increase quality, and I think that as a result, Verdicchio is very interesting to me, and it's got a good, bright future.
At the end of the show, we're going to taste it, and we'll get into a little more detail. Before we get to the wine list in our weekly wine sip, I want to talk to you about your own wine project, Gothic Wine.
Yeah.
Gothic Wine is, I'll set it up, it's a winery that you started almost 10 years ago.
That's
in
true.
In the Willamette Valley of Oregon.
Yeah.
And take it from there. You specialize in?
In Pinot Noir. And we make a little bit of Chardonnay and a little bit of Rosé from Pinot Noir as well.
Why Willamette?
Well, we looked at Sonoma as well. We actually made a little bit of wine in Sonoma the first year in 2008. We just thought the value was there in the Willamette, and we liked the terroir, the available water when you want it. And what people don't realize about Oregon is actually it doesn't rain in June, July, and August, which is perfect. They get all their rain in the fall and the spring and the winter.
During harvest or a little
no,
after?
No, after. After. That's the only thing you really have to worry about there is get your fruit in before the fall rains start. And we loved the people. We met fantastic grape growers and winemakers. They were very, very open with us and provided us with a lot of great opportunities there. So we immediately went in and we started with, I think we made 900 cases our first year. And we said, if it blows up in our face, we will sell it at our restaurants and we'll say that was fun. And we lost a few dollars. So now 10 years later, we in our biggest vintage made 7,000 cases
of
wine. Wow,
congrats.
We're distributed in 12 or 13 states. The wines are well received by guests and sommeliers and some trade publications when we've submitted them for scores. They do well. And we make
Can you get them in selected restaurants?
Yeah,
let's talk New York for starters. Retail, it's available.
I think there's a few places who have it retail. You know, Bottle Rocket had some of our wines for a little bit. Crush in Midtown had some of our kind of single vineyard.
So
kind
if
of
you
more,
want it, it's
around a little bit. Yeah.
What
but
vintage?
It's definitely more of a restaurant. Well, now we're selling 14 reds, I think, and we're, I think the rosé is...
Why so far back? Is everything in the barrel that long, or...?
No, there are some wines that we don't release for a couple of years, because
it's
in bottles, just not ready yet.
Right.
We've got a little bit of our core wine. 2014 was also an exceptional vintage, maybe the best in recent memory for Oregon, so we're very happy to have it.
Since then, what's another good vintage?
They've all been pretty good.
They've had a good run.
Well, they've had a good run of warm vintages, a little high octane compared to what they're used to.
Right.
We're pretty excited about this year getting back to normal.
So if people want to know more about Gothic, go to the website?
Yeah, check out the website. We have a core wine called Nevermore. My business partner in this, William Tigert, who owns Freeman's restaurant and fellow barber with a friend, he has a degree in literature for the University of Michigan. So all the branding and all the it's kind of like a couple of Edgar Allan Poe references. We have
a little heady.
The Ophelia is our Chardonnay. Then Telltale is our Rosé. It's kind of you go to Oregon and it's
you get a writer and a lithographer together. And
that's what happens.
Right?
But you go to Oregon, it's foggy. It's a little kind of evocative of Gothic kind of stuff. So,
right.
Yeah.
So that's Gothic wine.
Yeah.
It's
very delicious.
Delicious, well curated Pinot Noir and a little Chardonnay. All right, Josh, time to subject you to the wine list.
All right, let's do it.
Let's buzz through these quickly. Don't dwell on these, all right? All right, so the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's sort of on your table at home or you're tasting through at the restaurant? Could be seasonal. I'm not saying what's your favorite. I'm saying, what are you drinking now?
Drinking a lot of Syrah from the Northern Rhone. I love those wines. There's a softness to it. There's just a deliciousness to it.
Give me a favorite, too. First region, Cornas, Saint Joseph.
No, I'm more of like a Côte Rôtie Hermitage Saint Joseph guy.
Okay, give me one or two.
Gonon is a fantastic Saint Joseph.
Harder to get than
not
ever.
Not reinventing the wheel there. The wines of actually a new producer for Saint Joseph, Cession, that my friend Patrick Capiello is bringing in. Cecillon.
Okay.
Just beautiful wines and young
reasonable.
People. Yeah, reasonable, young.
Okay.
I don't know how much of it is out there. I love Côte Rôtie, so aromatic, so beautiful. And Hermitage is wine that's, needs
right.
a little bit
of age. Chave, Jamet.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Who else? I like the wines from Faury, Faury. They're a little bit different. They're not quite as the geeks don't love as much. I just think they're delicious, though.
All right, those are all great answers. So Northern Rhone right now.
Yep.
I'm with you on that. I saw Dustin and Thomas yesterday, and they're launching Reboul coming up.
Reboul part two.
Yeah, which should be nice. All right, Josh Nadel's favorite wine and food pairing. Does it exist? Is there something you like, go back to?
I mean, I love everything with lamb, red Burgundy, Barolo. My marriage
so take
is
lamb
like,
and just and throw so, good wines
yeah,
at it.
Yeah, my like the core my courtship.
Lamb is the canvas. The yeah. wines. Okay.
Yeah.
Nobody's courtship. Ever approached that question that way. I like
well,
that.
I mean, my courtship with my wife was based largely on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice to hear. Good story. All right. Can you tell me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And you're not going to leave anyone out. You're not going to insult anyone. It's just where do you find yourself or who do you look to that has expertise, selection, service towards wine?
This is in the U.S., in New York.
Yeah. I mean, New York is...
Okay. You know, I like seeing Pascaline at Racine's.
Racine's is
a
favorite.
Her wine list is amazing right now. Her food, you know, I loved her previous chef. And, of course... Paul's a pretty amazing talent. And, you know, I'm often around Tribeca, Soho and those kind of areas. So I would say she's kind of her spots are my go-to.
I agree with you on that. It comes up often. Josh Nadel's favorite all-time wine or two? Is there one that – or give me an experience or something that just stands out.
I mean, I have a couple.
Give me a couple. We got to go
recent,
quick.
Some recent, some old. Favorite Bordeaux of all time, either 59 Lafitte or 55 Mission Orion.
That's my birth year.
55?
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to, when I worked at Veritas, our Christmas party, the second year, the owner at the time, Stephen Verlin, told me to go downstairs and get the, what was it, 6 liter or something of 59
Jesus
Lafitte
Christ.
And open it for the staff at our Christmas party.
Jesus.
I still have the empty bottle out on display.
That's how deep this guy's list was. And he was the Bordeaux guy?
No, he was the all good wine guy. He had all the good wine.
Okay.
But it was at the time, it was $25,000 on the list. I'm sure it's probably 20 times that now.
Yeah, crazy.
But and he opened it for the staff at our Christmas party. It's right out of the original wood box.
So that's an incredible wine, incredible vintage, and an incredible sort of
memory.
Experience.
Yeah,
so we'll take that. All right. Tell me the best wine around $15-$20 retail that you would recommend to my kids for a dinner. Give me a red, give me a white. You can give me the maker, you can give me the region, like you could say Loire or whatever. Chenin.
Sure. I mean, I think the best... I was recently having a conversation with somebody, and I declared something the Floyd Mayweather of wine. The wine's from Produttori del Barbaresco, and they have an entry-level wine. They're quote-unquote Langhe Nebbiolo. I think their crew Barbaresco are probably the best wine. When you're talking about like really ambitious, age-worthy wines, maybe the best wine for the dollar in the world.
When you say the crew, like the Rabaja, the Asilio, then they make a non-designate.
They make a basic Barbaresco, but they make a Langhe Nebbiolo.
Okay.
And that's a wine that I don't know how much it'll cost you, but probably under 25.
Okay.
And that's
killer for that.
Extraordinary.
Right. That plays way up. Give me a white.
You know, and for the red, everybody else is going to talk about. A lot of people are going to talk about Cru Beaujolais, but those are getting expensive now too.
I know.
You know, they're.
You could still find stuff.
I don't know what the hell happened, but good Beaujolais is killer.
Yeah.
For white, for just you know the Alsatian wines are a little expensive for that. It's tough to get the good ones. You know, Domaine Weinbach makes a Riesling called Cuvée Theo.
All right, so stop theorizing about what we can't get. You know, just give me something.
There's actually a Verdicchio from Felici, F-E-L-I-C-I.
An Italian Verdicchio, Felici.
Yeah,
you can get that 20-ish?
15. Less.
Okay.
Less. And that's a wine. I think he's one of the really, really talented young producers there.
And we're going to taste a Verdicchio.
Yeah,
so we'll talk about, you know, the characteristics.
Yeah.
All right. So good job there, Josh.
I'm glad
we'll
I passed
post
the audition.
Yep, you had some good practice, about 19 years worth. We're going to post your answers on our social media.
Right.
So people, if you're interested, as always, we'll put them there. All right, last segment of the show, weekly wine sip. I'll bring a wine in. Most of the time I ask my guests because they have access and expertise to bring in stuff. So we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, Josh brought in a Verdicchio. We have about 3 minutes.
Sure.
We're going to talk, taste. Tell me about the wine.
Well, you know, Verdicchio, of course, I just came back from this trip. And Verdicchio has this interesting capability to be harvested early and be delicious, or be harvested later and be delicious. And like I said, I'm full disclosure, I like ripe, luscious, later harvested white wines. Not sweet, but just full of sun right. and flavor. And this is a later harvested Verdicchio from Tenuta del Ugolino. And I recently started getting a little bit more into organic and naturally made wines that were not flawed, but just made it. People are getting better at making them because they have more right. experience at them.
This is a good example of it.
Yeah, and this is a good example of an organically certified vineyard where they use a little bit less than commercially practice SO2 and things like that, and they're not using adjuncts or nutrients and things like that, which leans this wine a little bit towards the organic and things like that. So it's a later harvest Verdicchio, and as I'm sure you can tell, it is full of flavor and sun
nose.
And ripeness.
Yeah,
it's unadulterated.
I mean, let's evaluate.
Milk.
Let's start with color. It's a beautiful golden yellow.
Yeah, it's not.
It's
like
not a light Pinot right. Grigio.
Right.
Or
and it has no. It, you know, it's not. It's not quite. Pale straw with a lot of green. It's got almost a pale yellow or golden color, and that's because the grapes have a little more color in their
Let's
skins.
Let's go nose.
Yeah,
give me your
nose,
descriptors.
We're all about the really ripe center of the honeydew here.
Okay, so honeydew, ripe, but ripe.
Not like the, oh shit, I just paid $9 for a little plastic container of underripe near the rind melon.
Okay.
And pears and really ripe green Bartlett pears and some lemons, but they're kind of confit lemon peels. They're not like zested or anything like that. So
non-food, like any minerality, stony, or not a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean,
there.
I that's very subjective also. But you know, to me, there's a wet rock, and when I talk about mineral in a wine, it's that it's not so sun drenched and not so oaked and not so messed with that there isn't room for the wine to give you a sense of where it's from or how it was grown. You know, rocks don't smell or taste like anything.
Right.
So it's a little bit more than that.
Right. Let's go mouthfeel. To me, it's a very plush, nice, mouth-filling wine. I mean, I go medium plus or something.
Yeah, it's a medium, maybe medium plus bodied wine. Yeah. And it's round. It's not super lean or mean. Although there is crisp, like moderate plus acidity to the wine. And it would be great with food. But there's a ripeness and a lushness to the wine
so
that comes
give me
from
palate. Does the nose transfer to the palate?
Yeah, I think there's some even more ripe fruit here. You could even go into like a mango situation. There is a little bit of what I call a leasiness to the wine, which is a yeast contact with the wine that like on the finish, like a nut skin or something like that. But really, really beautiful ripeness. To me, this is about ripeness and sunshine, but not oak.
Right. All right, we got a minute left. What foods would you pair this with?
You know, salads, cheeses, seafood.
Okay. We don't like this wine. We love this wine, right?
Yeah, I love this wine.
It's a delicious wine.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful wine, and it's actually not currently imported to the United States.
Great. So just tell everyone again what it is slowly.
It's the Tenuta del Ugolino,
right.
Verdicchio di Castello Diesi, Classico Superiore, and that's important when you're looking at Verdicchio's.
I'll put a photo of it too when we post everything.
And it's a single vineyard here, Vigneto del Baluccio, and that's important because the vines are quite
right.
old.
That's why I'll do a picture. All right, Josh, we did it. We did it within the hour. You did the wine list. We tasted wine. We got you through everything. All right. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook @thegrapenation. Follow us on Instagram @sbenruby and follow the #thegrapenation on Twitter @benruby. Also subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. We'll post Josh's wine list and the weekly wine sip selection on all our social media sites. Josh, if we want to follow Josh, where do we find him on social media?
Find me on Instagram @JoshuaNadel.
Okay. And NoHo Hospitality Group, if you want to know more about it, they have their own website, NoHo Hospitality. You can go to that. All right. Thank you to our guest, Master Sommelier Josh Nadel. Thank you to our engineer. We have Matt today. And I think we're going to be seeing him a lot more. And thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.